अविशुद्ध अनप्योरिफाइड कर्तुहु ऑफ द डूअर ट्रांसलेशन एंड पर्पोर्ट बाय श्रील प्रभुपाद की जय। Dheeraj, can you open one section of that window? I can't breathe. The individual soul, bereft of Krishna consciousness, has many ideas and activities created in the mind by the external energy. They have been existing from time immemorial. Sometimes they are manifest in the awakening state and in the dream state, but during deep sleep, unconsciousness or trance, they disappear. A person who is liberated in this life, Jivan Mukta, can see all these things vividly. Purport. As stated in the Bhagavad Gita, chapter 13, text 3, Kshetragyam cha pimam vidhi sarva kshetreshu bharata. There are two kinds of kshetragya, or living beings. One is the individual living being and the other is the supreme living being. The ordinary living being knows about his body to some extent, but the supreme Paramatma knows the condition of all bodies. The individual living being is localized and the supreme Paramatma is all-pervading. In this shloka, the word Kshetragya refers to an ordinary living being, not the supreme living being. This ordinary living being is of two kinds, Nityabhadda and Nityamukta. One is eternally conditioned and the other is eternally liberated. The eternally liberated living beings are in the Vaikuntha Jagat, the spiritual world, and they never fall into the material world. Those in the material world are conditioned souls, Nityabhadda. The Nityabaddhas can become liberated by controlling the mind because the cause of conditioned life is the mind. When the mind is trained and the soul is not under the mind's control, the soul can be liberated even in this material world. When it is liberated, one is called Jivan Mukta. A Jivan Mukta knows how he has become conditioned. Therefore, he tries to purify himself and return home back to Godhead. The eternally conditioned soul is eternally conditioned because he is controlled by the mind. The conditioned state and liberated state are compared to the sleeping, unconscious state and the awakened state. Those who are sleeping and unconscious are eternally conditioned, but those who are awake understand that they are eternally part and parcel of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Krishna. Therefore, even in this material world, they engage in Krishna's service. As confirmed by Srila Rupa Goswami, Iha yasya harir dasye, if one takes to Krishna's service, he is liberated, even though he appears to be a conditioned soul within the material world. Jivan mukta sa uchyate, in any condition, one is to be considered liberated if his only business is to serve Krishna. Om Ajnana Timirandhasya Gyananjana Shalakaya Chaksur Unmilitam Yena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha Shri Chaitanya Manobhishtam Sthapitam Yena Bhutale Swayam Rupa Kadamahim Dadati Swapadantikam Vancha Kalpataru Vyashcha Kripa Sindhubhya Evacha पतितानां पावनेभ्यो वैष्णवेभ्यो नमो नमः जय श्री कृष्ण चैतन्य प्रभु नित्यानंद श्री अद्वैत गदाधर श्रीवासादि गौर भक्तवृंद हरे कृष्ण 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 हरे 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 राम 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 हरे हरे। टुडे इज एक्चुअली माधवेंद्र पुरी प्रभुस टर्न, but there's all likelihood that I'll be out of town the next couple of days, out of Chicago, within the Chicago area, but out of Chicago. And so he very kindly swapped turns. The basis for this discussion is First of all, the word Kshetrajna, the knower of the field of activities. In the Bhagavad Gita, of the 18 chapters, it is described that the first 6 chapters talk about karma. The last 6 chapters talk about jnana. And the middle 6 talk about bhakti. So Krishna has provided a wonderful sandwich. And it actually means that without bhakti in the middle, jnana on this side and karma on this side have no meaning. Any activities, unless it is laced with or tinged with bhakti, the activities are meaningless. And knowledge without bhakti as an influence has no meaning. Last night I was very touched by a statement Prabhu made that modern education is all about adding new layers of information, getting new facts together. And the process, the Vedic education, is to remove layers of misconception. Because the soul inherently is all cognizant, all knowledgeable. But over the course of existing in this material world, we have accumulated so much garbage. And that's what this purport is talking about. The verse says, the individual soul bereft of Krishna consciousness has many ideas and activities created in the mind by the external energy. So the punishment or the outcome, the consequence of turning away from Krishna is such that the mind is flooded by all these different conceptions and ideas of activities, of what will make one happy, what to do, what not to do, how to make money, how to live happily. All garbage ideas. And it is called Maya Rachitasya. Rachita means manufactured or created. And so all these ideas are creation of the external potency of Krishna. They are not genuine, they are not true. And because it is Maya, it appears as true. And boy, does it appear like really real for us. So this is the trick. Maya means it convinces us of a truth that doesn't exist. It convinces of an existence that doesn't exist. It doesn't exist means it's artificial. It convinces us of something has value when it doesn't have value. It convinces of us of happiness in things and activities that are actually not at all, have nothing to do with happiness. That is the meaning of the word Maya, that which does not exist, that which is not, Maya. And so, the mind is that energy or that element that gets the most influenced. And because the mind is influenced, everything else is influenced. Activities, conceptions, desires, thoughts, ideas, etc. And that's what constitutes a living being. Especially the human being. I mean, all species of life. In other species, it's actually worse. Because you can't tell a hog, Hari Bol, you're a soul. He will look at us, grunt, and walk away. You can't tell an ass, don't work like this. It won't make any difference to him. But human beings also, it doesn't make any difference to them, but we can see from our lives that we were in those conditions. We had certain ideas that money will make us happy, education will make us happy, or something, some name will make us happy, or whatever, to reject everything and live like a hippie will make us happy. Once when Srila Prabhupada arrived in Dallas at the airport, someone asked him a question, "Swamiji, what will happen if the Krishna consciousness movement spreads far and wide?" And Prabhupada said, "There will be no more hippies." So then they asked him, "Swamiji, who is a hippie?" And Prabhupada said, "You know better than me." Something extraordinary. And the reporter burst into a laughter. He said, "Something extraordinary. The hippie idea is that they let the mind drive them wild. Whatever comes to their mind, do like that. If this feels good, do it. If it feels good, do it. Whatever it is. Take drugs, have sex, jump out of the building, or walk around naked." Well, there were all these activities. Now, it's not like hippie is some stereotype idea that they have to have big collars and long hair and long sideburns. Okay, that may be the case in some historical context, but there are hippies even today. A hippie means letting the mind rule and do as you like. Feels good, do it. And 5 minutes later, if it doesn't feel good, hey, what to do? It felt good 5 minutes ago, so it was okay. I did it because I felt like it. So Jada Bharata is speaking about hippies. And the idea is to transform hippies into happies. Because the hippies, we are called Nitya Baddhas. Nitya Baddha, Nitya means eternal, or, and Baddha is bound. What are they bound to or bound by? They're bound by their mind. The mind convinces us that we are human, or we are an animal, or we are an insect, or a bird, or whatever. It is the mind that convinces us. It's actually the false ego, but it's through the mind, as we read a few verses ago. And so it makes us a hippie. The hippie is these wild, wild things that come to the mind. And in Krishna consciousness, to transform from hippie to happy, we have to have what is called Vaidhi Sadhana Bhakti. Because in Vaidhi Sadhana Bhakti, we're not allowed to be hippies. A hippie means, today I don't feel like doing this service for Krishna. Then Vaidhi Sadhana doesn't allow for that. It says everyone should do these services every day. It's not a factor of how your mind tells you, what your mind tells you. Or the opposite. Hey, today I'm very inspired. I'm going to make 75 offerings for the deities. And tomorrow, to find where that bhakta is not going to work. Where is he? Today I feel like sleeping because my mind doesn't inspire me to do anything. To remove these super variegated pendulum-like influences of the mind, our acharyas gave us the Vaidhi Sadhana Bhakti, the regulated devotional service. And the regulated devotional service says, do it out of duty, whether you like it or you don't like it. That's the first step. Or even before duty, there's obedience. You have to be obedient to higher order. Obedience transforms to duty. And duty transforms to love. So to bring about obedience in a disobedient mind is not easy. Try as much, it doesn't work. So we need another influence, the influence of mercy. So therefore, sadhana bhakti is painful in the beginning, because we're trying to discipline the mind under higher order, order of guru, order of sadhu, order of shastra. So it feels very uncomfortable. And it's that discomfort is what is pure, is the purificatory sense. Because we are uncomfortable, we're getting purified. Oh, I don't like to do it, but what to do? My spiritual master has said I should, therefore I will. I don't have any sense of appreciation of what I'm doing, but I have to be obedient. That's the first order of business. Be obedient. And that is how we get purified. Purified means that the sense of discomfort over time goes away. And it starts becoming something that is tasteful. We look forward to it. We look forward to serving the devotees. We look forward to serving Krishna. We look forward to rendering different services like that. Otherwise the mind, very, very painful. It tells us what to do, what not to do. And it has no sense of discipline. So here, such a living being who is driven by the mind is called Nitya Baddha. And a person who has controlled his mind is called Nitya Mukta. Or one who has been liberated from that influence of the mind becomes Jivan Mukta. So Prabhupada describes that there are two categories of people. This is described in the 15th chapter of Bhagavad Gita. Dvavimau purushau loke ksharaschakshara evacha ksharasarvani bhutani kutasthokshara iti uchyate. He says that in this material world there are two types of living beings, kshara and akshara. Kshara means those who fall, those whose consciousness can become diluted. That is, the consciousness is influenced by material energy. And akshara means those whose consciousness cannot be influenced by material energy. And he says, kshara sarvani bhutani. In this material world, all the living entities are fallen. We have the tendency to use language in Krishna consciousness that is a little odd for people coming from outside. We use phrases like I was spacing out, I was under the modes of nature, I was resting. It was a different way of saying that I was completely knocked out by sleep, or say I was under the mode of ignorance, etc. So we have certain language, we say certain things. So this Krishna says that all living entities in this world are fallen. So one time a devotee who was in the presence of Srila Prabhupada, he was speaking something and he said to Prabhupada, "Srila Prabhupada, I am most fallen." And Prabhupada replied, "You're most nothing." Because the statement, "I'm most fallen," was actually a statement of pride. It's a fashionable way of saying. So Prabhupada said, "You're most nothing." Which means we are actually insignificant. The insignificance is that the living spark, which is a part and parcel of Krishna, which has so much intrinsic value, that intrinsic value, because we have accepted the mind as our spiritual master, that intrinsic value is so diminished that it has absolutely no spiritual spark in it. The Sat Chit Ananda living entity is the embodiment of Asat, Achit and Nirananda. We're quite the opposite. So we are insignificant in that sense. Otherwise the living entity is quite significant in and of himself. Not in comparison to Krishna, but in and of himself. He is eternal, he is fully cognizant and always blissful. That is pretty significant. But because we accept the mind as guru, we've taken initiation from guru. So that mind initiates us and gives us a name, Mudha, Vimudha, different names it gives us. And we chant many rounds of the Maya mantra. Aham mameti, aham mameti, I and mine, I and mine, I and mine. That is the sadhana for the conditioned soul. And from there, the real spiritual master, the Sadguru. Sadguru means the real spiritual master. The mind is called Asadguru. It's not substantial. So how to go from Nitya Baddha stage to Nitya Mukta stage? From eternally bound to liberated. And he's describing that the way to do it is by controlling the mind. When the mind is trained and the soul is not under the mind's control, the soul can be liberated even in this material world. In the Nectar of Devotion, Rupa Goswami gives a principle for a person who is liberated from the influence of mind. Iha yasya harer dasya manasa karmana vacha nikhilasvapi avastashu jivan mukta sa uchyate. That a person who has dedicated his mind, body and words in the service of Krishna, such a person, although in the material world, is considered fully liberated. Jivan mukta sa uchyate. And Prabhupada's referring to that verse. So as we allow for our mind, body and words to be directed by higher order or regulated by Guru, Sadhu and Shastra, that is the only way to move to the liberated state. When you use the word liberated, it means opposite of incarcerated or bound. The incarceration or the being bound up is that the mind is like an adhesive. It captures the soul. And the strength of that adhesion, the strength of that stickiness, is by the desires that one has within the mind, the variety of them. And the more intense they are about the mode of ignorance and passion, the tighter the grip of the mind. In the mode of goodness, it is still binding, but it is not so bad. One may be bound to happiness and knowledge, but at least it's progressive. It's in the direction of becoming unbound. But the mode of ignorance and passion, they exert a very tight knot. And to loosen that knot, Krishna describes in different ways in the Bhagavad Gita. It's described a little differently in Bhagavatam. But Krishna says one must take the weapon of detachment and cut that knot. So it's an active process. It doesn't happen in some romantic way. Oh, the knot in the heart will go away. The weapon of detachment is to act on the instructions of the spiritual master. That's the weapon of detachment. I'm attached to an idea. My guru has a different idea or an instruction, and I accept that instruction. That's the detachment. That weapon removes the knot in the heart very quickly, to the degree that we accept that. And in the Bhagavatam is described a little differently. It's the same principle. Vidyate hridaya grantis chidyate sarvasamkshaya. kriyate chasya karmani drushta evatmanishvare. That the knot in the heart is pierced and cut, and all the doubts that exist are vanquished. And one's kriyate chasya karmani means one's fruitive activities, means those influenced by the mind. Yeah, do this, it's nice, it feels good, do it. Those vanish. So the first indication that we are heading in the right direction, is as soon as the mind says, do this, or don't do this, when the devotee refers to higher order, should I or should I not? My mind tells me, do this or don't do this, what should I do? That's the first indication that we're heading in the right direction. But just because the mind says do it or don't do it, to go with that program is also a symptom that something is not right. What something is not right means that's the doorway for further entanglement. And Jada Bharat is telling us, or Srila Prabhupada is telling us, that the conditioned state and liberated state are like the sleep state and the awakened state. In sleep state, the dreams are continuing, all sorts of bizarre dreams. And in the waking state, a person is active in his real activities. So to be influenced by the mind means to be allowed, or to allowing, it means allowing the mind to keep us in a sleep state. It's called a zombie state. It doesn't allow the intelligence or the soul's conscious choice making propensity work. And the mind just carries the living entity from this condition to that condition. And awake state means while the noise is happening, to be able to have sufficient conviction to not listen to it. The conviction to not listen to the mind comes from what's called hridaya balam, the strength of heart. We discussed a few days ago. Bhaktivinoda Thakur describes why we don't have taste in chanting. So he gave four reasons. One was tattva vibhrama, that we have wrong understanding of truth. Second, asat trishna, that we have intense taste for the temporary. A third is called hridaya daurbalyam, weakness of heart. And the fourth is called aparad, or offensive mentality. Hridaya daurbalyam essentially is when we know what to do, but we don't do it. And when we know what not to do, but we continue. We know we should not do some things, but we continue doing. And we know we should do some things, but we don't have sufficient drive to doing it. So how to go from a weak state like that to a strong state? How does anyone go from weak state to strong state? When one is weak, health-wise, let's say, there is medicine and diet. From medicine and diet, one's health recovers. Or if a particular muscle is weak, then that muscle is exercised, little by little. Not if someone wants to build their biceps, it's not like they'll go pick up 100 pounds the day, first day. But what they'll do is they'll pick up lighter weights and just get used to the whole idea of lifting that weight. And slowly, as the muscle becomes a little stronger, it goes to heavier weights. And as they continue, then that particular muscle develops. And while it is developing, there is some soreness. So that's nice. That's an indication that something's working. So when we're trying to go from the weak state to the strong state, there is a little pain somewhere. The pain of saying no to the mind. So there are two ways of saying no to the mind. It's just keep saying no, no, no to the mind. Prabhupada here says, instead say yes to Krishna. Say yes to scripture. Say yes to sadhu and guru. Say yes. And that's the way of building that strength. And there is pain in it. We know that that particular muscle is working because it's like, oh, I don't want to say yes, but what to do? The spiritual master said, do. So I have to do. The Shastra says, perform Vaidhi Sadhana Bhakti. I have to do. I don't like it. The mind says, don't do it. Today it's okay to not do. But no. When such exercise happens, then that heart becomes stronger. In fact, Krishna chastises Arjuna for his weakness of his heart. He says, Tyaktva hridaya daurbalyam uttishta. He says, drop this petty weakness of heart and get up and fight. That get up and fight instruction is, don't give in to your mind. Your mind is telling you all these reasons why you should not fight. And by the way, they're good reasons. They're good from a moral standpoint, they're good from an ethical standpoint, they're good from a an individual standpoint, social standpoint. They're all good, no doubt. But don't give in to your mind. Because your mind is not considering a very simple factor. You know, socially it's right, morally it's right, all that seems all right. But you're missing a whole big point. What is pleasing to Krishna? And that's when Arjuna realizes. He says, smritir lab, nashta moha smritir labdhava. And therefore he says, karishe vachanam tava. I will do as you say, because now my bewilderment has gone away. The bewilderment is, I continue to choose what my mind says, versus choosing what Krishna is saying. And to do that, the heart needs to become stronger. So we start somewhere, small instructions. We say yes to those. And from those small instructions, we take on bigger instructions. So it's easier to say yes, like that. So in this verse and purport, Kshetrajna refers to the living entity. In tomorrow's verses, Kshetrajna refers to the super soul, because there are two Kshetrajnas, the living entity and the super soul. And the living entity has limited knowledge about the environment he is in, or it is in. That environment is this body. We don't know everything about the body. We're just conscious of every part of the body. So he's called Sarvaga. His consciousness is spread throughout the body. But we have no idea. We can't even try, and we should not even try to know what's happening in someone else's body. We can't. Not that we don't try to understand others' feelings and pains. That's not my point. We have no capacity to experience the feelings of others, because our consciousness is limited to this body. And the only way to experience, or I guess empathize with others' feelings, is when the Paramatma speaks, this is how it feels. Then we understand. Otherwise we have no direct experience of it. But Paramatma is the soul in all bodies, and he has full knowledge about all living entities throughout eternity. And he never forgets. And so tomorrow, Charabhat's going to refer to the super soul. So any questions or comments, anything you'd like to say?
We talk about the Vedas being very concise, like you were saying in the beginning of the lecture. But one verse comes to mind: those who are irresolute in purpose, their intelligence is many branched, and those who are resolute in purpose, their aim is one. I'm trying to think what chapter that was from.
Chapter 2, text 41.
Oh, thank you.
The Vedas are not concise. In fact, the Vedas are very elaborate. But the Vedas are very eloquent. The definition of eloquence is truth spoken concisely. So there are many aphorisms, and those aphorisms are very thoroughly explained. There is mind-boggling detail that the Vedas go into. And by Vyasadeva's mercy, they are perfectly organized. They're perfectly organized according to the consciousness of the living entities, the human being. In fact, it covers the entire range of human consciousness. And that's Vyasadeva's very special mercy to cater to every level of consciousness.
In a mundane realm, Stephen Douglas, who said to Abraham Lincoln, you know, before Abraham Lincoln gave the Gettysburg Address, Stephen Douglas went on and on. And then after Abraham Lincoln gave the Gettysburg Address, he says, he has said in 3.5 minutes what took me 25 minutes to say. So, you know, that's something that came to mind. American history, Prabhu.
Thank you. And what took him 3.5 minutes, and just to be tacky here, Vyasadeva said it in one line. He said, janmadhyasa yataha, or atato brahma jikyasa, because everything they might have spoken is not Brahma, it is something else, it's Brahma. In Sanskrit, Brahma means spiritual, and Brahma means mirage. So Gettysburg Address is most likely Brahma. Something. Anyway, I don't care. Okay, anything else on this side? Siddharth?
So you mentioned in the class again and again that it's the mind which tells us that this is the way to be happy, and we are slave to the mind. Mind is our Asad Guru.
Mind is our Asad Guru.
Yeah, but in reality we are where we are. I mean, a mind is conditioned in one way. So what's a good tactic? Should we just accept what it is and try to gradually improve, or...
So I explained that... That is our condition. It is a pitiable condition. So what to do? So the first step is obedience to higher order. That's the first step. If we begin culturing that obedience to Shastra, then the mind starts to becoming, the mind starts to get trained. If there is no obedience to Shastra, there is no other solution. Other methods will be to strive very hard to not listen to the mind, or try very hard to let the mind not speak. That's a mechanical process. It's not recommended in Krishna consciousness. So first recommended is obedience to Guru. That's the culturing of the mind.
Mind is feeling, etc. Because even to Guru we have to say the state of mind, right? Or
to the Guru we have to tell our state of mind? No, he understands. We don't have to tell. Just the way we show up for Mangal Arati, the state of mind is very clear. No, we don't have to express the state of mind. The state of mind for the Guru to assess is from the question and answer modality. As the disciple asks questions, the state of mind becomes clear. And that's why the disciple must ask questions. And the guru can give answers to address and to discipline the mind according to those conceptions.
We don't really ask questions directly to the guru so many times, right? We just ask.
No, we should.
In the Bhagavatam class.
No, not true. True in my experience. And someone doesn't ask, then they're depriving themselves. No, guru is not just Diksha Guru. Guru is a term meant for those who are giving a siksha also. In ISKCON, we sometimes overemphasize guru means Diksha Guru. It's not necessary. It's not the right application of that word. Yes, Diksha Guru has ultimate, authority. But guru means siksha gurus also. Well, we should ask. Anything else? Prabhu?
Thank you very much. Wonderful class. Do we have to ask our Diksha Guru for shelter of a Siksha Guru?
That is proper etiquette. Because one has one Diksha Guru and many Siksha Gurus. One can have many Siksha Gurus. Not that one has always. One can have more than one Siksha Guru. And whenever there is some instruction given, all the Siksha Gurus have to refer to the Diksha Guru's instruction. So if the Diksha Guru has given this, let's say, this type of instruction, the Siksha Guru should not give that kind of instruction. That's opposite to or against or violating the Diksha Guru's instruction. The Siksha Guru should support and nurture the Diksha Guru's instructions. And so, yes, one should, the proper etiquette is to seek the Diksha Guru's permission before accepting other Siksha Gurus. Yeah, just proper. Shyamananda Pandit, he was a disciple of Hridaya Chaitanya. And he was sent to Jiva Goswami to get trained in certain aspects of bhakti. And so Jiva Goswami did not supersede in his instructions, the instructions of Hridaya Chaitanya, like that. Is that okay? Yes.
In the time and energy that you want to put into it, you could elucidate it a little bit further. This is an interesting point. In relation to what you were saying, obedience, duty, and love come in that order. So, we're all attached to different modes of nature when we come to the bhakti process. So somebody who may be more affected by attachment to a mode of goodness may think that they are already dutiful, but that skips the obedience platform. So then love won't actually manifest because it's not part of the real relationship with Krishna that brings one through the modes of nature to that point. It seems to me anyway, that's my thought.
One is dutiful. Obedience is part of duty. Is that?
It depends on where the obedience lies. It may be just to my conception of what is good or something like that, as opposed to spiritual master. So then if maybe what I'm saying is not correct, I'm just trying to understand that conception clearly. It seems that one could already be attached to the idea of serving Krishna without having a spiritual master directly, like a Diksha Guru or something like that. So how can they make progress like that without having that connection? You see what I'm saying? Like, it seems like they're already beyond the obedience platform.
Yeah, that's not love. Because obedience means Krishna says, one who's my devotee's devotee is my devotee. Then they're obedient to the mind's conception that why do I need devotees? It's between me and Krishna. So that's wrong. Obedience means obedience to Shastra or Krishna's word. And duty includes obedience. Sometimes duty, the sense of duty, is up and down. And that up and down depends on how much the mind pushes the person away. So sometimes they're dutiful, sometimes they're like, wow, totally rebellious. And it fluctuates. So whenever they are dutiful, there is some progress. And whenever the mind rebels, then that progress pauses and the mind takes over and struggle happens, whatever. And when again the dutifulness manifests, a little bit more progress. But one who cultivates steady obedience and dutifulness makes more steady progress. The mind is the damper. It cuts. It checks progress. It's a conditioned mind, checks progress. And a purified mind facilitates progress. That's the instruction in the sixth chapter. Through your mind, elevate yourself. Yeah. So the giving into the mind is when the heart is weak.
Yeah, that was the other thing that you mentioned. That's one reason why I was expressing it the way that I was, that it seems like if you don't have that obedience connection, then even if you are so-called dutiful, that will fail because the heart hasn't been engaged
necessarily. The so-called dutiful is the mind's wave. The mind tells you, this is dutifulness. And then, but the dutifulness is the absolute reference point is Shastra, not the mind. So that sense of duty is all influenced by the mind. So what's the right sense of duty? It's during the difficult times to say yes to the instruction. That's the duty. And that's where the strength of heart comes in. One may do artificially, one may do it whatever way. Then there are consequences for that. But the sense of duty is actually checked when the mind says, do this, and the instruction says, do that. It depends on what we choose. That actually decides the sense of duty.
The bottom line is, it may seem that the way I had pictured it is that we're all going to be attached to different combinations of the modes of nature, and the connection to Guru Sadhu Shastra is to keep us steady, as you were explaining, on the path of sadhana bhakti, regardless of those fluctuations, and then we gradually make progress to purity. So it may seem that this conception, I'm sure, affects some of us, you know, that we, I want to do things in a goodness way. I can think of a specific example from Srila Prabhupada and one of his disciples, without going into that whole thing. I want to do things in this way, and it may seem that the spiritual master is asking something that doesn't seem to be as mode of goodness or something like that. So the mistake is thinking that the mode of goodness is the goal, kind of, as opposed to having the obedience solid platform.
Yeah, and
there.
It also depends on our conception of what is goodness. That's correct. That is correct. And sometimes the spiritual master allows that little wiggle room to let the mind, because if he bends it too hard, then we're done. So he knows. He's an expert at how. That's why we say tatradi dakshat ativallabhasya. Because he's such an expert, he knows how far to bend, when not to bend us, when to let go, when to be firm. That's his expertise, being driven by Krishna. So sometimes we say, I feel like doing this. Okay, very nice. My guru said I could do this. as an example of Prabhupada, somebody came and told Prabhupada, I want to travel around the world playing my guitar, something like that. And Prabhupada said, yes, do it. And in the morning or the previous day, he had given a very heavy lecture of not being whimsical like that. So the devotees asked, why did you say yes when yesterday you were so heavy about this? Prabhupada said he was anyway going to do it. And if he were to do it against my desire, then it's very harmful for his spiritual life. So I said, do it. At least that way he's still within the bounds or boundaries of instruction. So is to understand the nuances of the spiritual master's instruction is very difficult. Therefore it says obedience. Don't try to evaluate the whole, just follow. Okay. Acharya, is there? Okay. Is it a short question?
Not really.
Not really? Okay. I don't want to go beyond.
I'll try to make it as concise as possible. But on the topic of the mind accepting obedience, and we're speaking in regards specifically to the order of the spiritual master, but I'm thinking in the modern ISKCON context how generally there can be limited contact with the guru, and our obedience more goes towards the way our authority system is set up in ISKCON.
Yeah.
So the nature of the mind is to be doubtful to surrender. Now, how are we, or how is it understood that whoever is giving instruction and guidance, for them to give perfect information to everyone that's under them, which seems a very high qualification. We see that sometimes in the history, following the system, trying to be obedient, but the leadership may be off. Are we to accept that the leadership in ISKCON has complete transparency to guide us in every different aspect or of our service, that we're making the best steps?
To generalize that all leadership is transparent is dangerous. That's not true. Some are not. So, how to know? Then we have some faculty of rationality to help us. And the rationality is to see how much they understand my situation and how much they're helping me bend against my mind. And it is always okay to check with other authorities. This is what I was told. What do you think? What do you think? And it's not because we're shopping for the right answer. You understand? My authority said this, but I really think that. I'll keep finding an authority till they agree with what I'm thinking. It's called shopping mentality. But every authority has an authority above them. And that's governance, or we call that as accountability. So a good leader is accountable to their superiors for any instruction or direction given. And rather than get into this whole complicated, is this leader transparent or not transparent, if we cultivate the general attitude of obedience, there is protection. You know that famous pastime of Srila Prabhupada? In New York, there was something happening that was totally against scriptural regulations. This was in Manhattan. Apparently they were offering even meat on the altar or something like that. This was a really bizarre thing was going on. And all the devotees kept just following that. Somewhere they felt it was not right, but they kept following. So when Srila Prabhupada came, or he was informed, then Prabhupada came to New York. And he invited all the young devotees, or subordinate devotees. He called them into the room and he said, you have followed my instruction. My instruction was that you follow your authority. And so you are not culpable for anything. You may go. He called the leaders in, and he blasted them like anything. So the principle was, the subordinate or whatever, the bhaktas or however you want to call it, the devotees, they followed. And Prabhupada said, you're protected because you followed. And that was my instruction. So if a devotee is genuine, sincere, then they will not get wrong advice. Krishna will participate, or Krishna is participating. And even if they get seemingly wrong advice, in that there is some truth to be known about themselves, about the process of Krishna consciousness, etc. So in that sense, there is no loss or diminution in any way. Is that okay? Okay. Thank you very much. Srila Prabhupada ki jai, Srimad Bhagavatam ki jai.